Chapter 13. Enter the Hero. And so the unknown man shook his finger at Ivan and whispered, "Shh." Ivan lowered his legs from the bed and peered into the darkness. A man of about 38 years of age was peeking in cautiously from the balcony. Clean-shaven, dark-haired, sharp-nosed, with troubled eyes, and a curl of hair hanging down on his forehead. After making sure that Ivan was alone and listening intently, the mysterious visitor stepped into the room. Here Ivan saw that the new arrival was dressed in hospital garb. He was wearing underclothes, slippers on his bare feet, and a brown robe thrown over his shoulders. The visitor winked at Ivan, replaced a bunch of keys in his pocket, and inquired in a whisper, "May I sit?" Receiving an affirmative nod, he settled in a chair. "How did you get here?" Ivan asked in a whisper.
"Praskovya Fyodorovna is a very sweet but, alas, absent-minded person. I stole a bunch of keys from her a month ago, and thus gained the ability to go out on the common balcony, which stretches around the entire floor. Thus, I can visit a neighbour every now and then."
"If you can get out on the balcony, you can take off. Or is it too high?" Ivan wondered.
"No," the guest replied firmly. "I cannot take off. Not because it's too high, but because I have nowhere to take off to."
And after a pause, he inquired,
"Occupation?"
"Poet," Ivan said reluctantly. "Very well, I'm prepared to take your word for it. Tell me yourself, are your poems any good?"
"They're monstrous,"
Ivan said all of a sudden with brave sincerity.
"Don't write any more," the guest beseeched him. "I promise and swear," Ivan said solemnly.
They sealed the oath with a handshake, and then light footsteps and voices came from the corridor.
"Shh," the guest whispered, and jumped out onto the balcony, closing the grating behind him.
Praskovya Fyodorovna looked inside, asked Ivan how he felt, and left after wishing the patient a good night.
And when everything quieted down, the guest returned. In a whisper, he relayed to Ivan that a new patient had just been delivered to room 119, some fat, purple-faced man who kept carrying on about foreign currency in the ventilation shafts and swearing that evil spirits had taken residence in his place on Sadovaya.
Anyway, God be with him.
"So why exactly did you end up here?"
"Because of Pontius Pilate,"
Ivan replied.
"What?"
the guest cried, forgetting all caution, and clamped his own mouth with his hand.
"An amazing coincidence, I beg you, do tell."
Feeling a strange sense of trust in the unknown man, Ivan began narrating yesterday's events at Patriarch's Ponds. The guest took the greatest interest in the story and became absolutely delighted as it progressed.
"And so," Ivan concluded, "I ended up here."
The guest placed his hand sympathetically on the poor poet's shoulder.
"Unfortunate poet, but you have only yourself to blame, dear boy. You can't be so casual and even insolent around him. So now you're paying the price. And you really ought to be thankful you got off rather cheaply."
"So who is he already?"
Ivan asked. The guest peered at Ivan and answered with a question.
"Now, you won't become agitated, will you?"
"No, no," Ivan exclaimed. "Tell me, who is he?"
"Very well. Yesterday, at Patriarch's Ponds, you met Satan." Ivan stuck to his promise and did not become agitated, but was nonetheless greatly flabbergasted.
"It couldn't be. He does not exist."
"Please,
you of all people are one to talk.
Here you are, sitting in a psychiatric ward and still talking of how he doesn't exist.
But what a pity that it was you who met him and not I. I swear I'd give Praskovya Fyodorovna's bundle of keys for such a meeting, for I have nothing else to give.
I am destitute."
"What do you want with him?" The guest moped and twitched for quite some time, but finally began.
Strange as it is, I am here because of Pontius Pilate, just as yourself.
Here the guest looked round fearfully and said,
The thing is, a year ago I wrote a novel about Pilate.
You're a writer?
The poet asked, intrigued.
I am a master.
He grew serious and extracted an extremely grimy black cap from the pocket of his robe, with an M stenciled on it in yellow silk. Putting it on, he showed himself to Ivan to prove that he was indeed a master.
She sewed it for me with her own two hands, he added mysteriously.
And what is your name?
I no longer have a name, the strange guest replied with dark contempt.
Then at least tell me about your novel,
Ivan asked tactfully.
Be my guest.
A historian by vocation, he had but 2 years ago worked in one of Moscow's museums and took up translations in his spare time. The historian lived alone, having no relatives anywhere and few friends in Moscow. And, believe it or not, one day he won 100,000 rubles.
Imagine my surprise, the guest in the black cap whispered, when I thrust my hand into the laundry bin and saw it. The number was the same as the one in the newspaper.
Having won 100 grand, Ivan's mysterious guest left his room on Myasnitskaya and rented a place from a private builder in an alley near the Arbat. He abandoned his job at the museum and began writing a novel about Pontius Pilate.
Ah, that was the golden age,
the narrator whispered, his eyes gleaming.
A completely separate apartment with a hall and a sink with running water.
The guest began measuring space with his hands. Here's the couch, opposite it, another couch, a small table in between, with a wonderful lamp on it. Books near the window, and here, a little desk.
Oh, what a place I had.
The scent of the lilacs was incredible, and my head grew light with fatigue, and Pilate flew towards the ending.
White cape, red lining,
Ivan exclaimed.
Exactly.
Pilate flew towards the ending, and I already knew that the last words in the novel would be, The fifth procurator of Judea, the knight Pontius Pilate. Well, naturally, I would go out for walks. Then the guest's eyes opened wide, and he continued to whisper, gazing at the moon.
She carried these revolting, disturbing yellow flowers in her hands.
She turned into an alley off Tverskaya, and then she looked back. Thousands of people were walking on Tverskaya, but I swear to you that she saw me alone. And I was stunned not so much by her beauty as by the extraordinary, unheard-of loneliness in her eyes. I also turned into the alley and followed in her tracks. We traversed the crooked, boring alley silently, I on one side and she on the other.
And imagine, she suddenly spoke. Do you like my flowers?
I crossed quickly to her side, approached and said, No. She looked at me in surprise, and I came to the sudden and completely unexpected realization that all my life I had been in love with this exact woman. Then I regretted saying it, for she smiled apologetically and threw her flowers in a ditch. We walked silently for a little while until she threaded her hand in a cuffed black glove through my arm, and we walked side by side.
Go on, said Ivan.
Love leapt at us like an assassin in a dark alley and struck us both at once. Of course, she would later insist that we had loved each other since time untold, not knowing each other, never seeing each other, while she lived with another man and I with that... What's her face?
You were married?
Well, yeah, to that... Varyonka? Manechka? I don't really remember. So then,
She would say that she went out that day carrying yellow flowers so that I would find her at last, and had that not happened, she would have poisoned herself, for her life was empty. Yes, love struck us instantly, and soon, very soon, this woman became my secret wife. She came to me every day. No one knew of our liaison. Her husband didn't know, nor did her friends. The people in the old house where I had my basement could certainly see that some woman came to visit me, but they did not know her name. Ivan learned that the master and the unknown woman fell in love so deeply that they became completely inseparable. She would arrive, put on an apron immediately, and light a paraffin stove on a wooden table in the narrow hall, next to the sink that the unfortunate patient was so strangely proud of. She would cook breakfast and serve it on the oval table in the first room. During the thunderstorms in May, the lovers would heat up the furnace and bake potatoes in it. When the storms passed and the humid summer came, the vase filled with roses, long-awaited and beloved by both. He who called himself the master would work, while she would sit and read over what he had written. She foresaw fame. She spurred him on, and it was then that she started calling him a master. She waited for the promised final words about the fifth procurator of Judea, and said that her whole life was in this novel. It was finished in the month of August, and given to some unknown typist who produced 5 copies of it. I stepped out into life, holding it in my hands, and then my life ended. The master whispered, and hung his head, and the sad black cap with the yellow M swayed in the air for a long time. For the first time, I found myself in the world of literature. I recall it with horror. Yes, he shocked me considerably.
Who?
Ivan whispered.
Why, the editor. Yes, so he read it. He stared at me and even sniggered in embarrassment. He asked me who I was and where I had come from, how long I had been writing, and why no one had heard of me before. He even asked who had given me the idea of writing a novel on such an odd subject. Finally, I grew tired of him and asked him straight out whether he would publish the novel or not. Here he began to fuss and mumble, had declared that he could not make this decision by himself, that other members of the editorial board would have to become acquainted with my work, namely the critics Latunsky and Ahriman, and the writer, Mstislav Lavrovich. He asked me to come back in 2 weeks. I returned in 2 weeks and was greeted by some girl whose eyes were practically crossed at her nose from constant lying.
"That's Lapshenikova, the editorial secretary,"
sneered Ivan, who was well acquainted with the world so angrily described by his guest. Anyhow, it was from her that I received my novel, at this point considerably grimy and tousled. Trying not to look me in the eyes, Lapshenikova informed me that the publishing house had enough material for 2 years ahead, and therefore the question of publishing my novel was, as she put it, not pertinent. "What else do I remember after this?" the master muttered. "I remember that accursed insert in the paper." And Ivan guessed from the subsequent jumbled phrases that some other editor had printed a large excerpt of the novel, written by the one who called himself the master. It was not 2 days before a different paper carried an article by the critic Ahriman, titled "Enemy Under an Editor's Wing." The article proclaimed that Ivan's guest had abused the editor's carelessness and ignorance and attempted to drag an apologia for Jesus Christ into print.
"Yes, I remember,"
Ivan exclaimed. A day later, an article signed by Mstislav Lavrovich appeared in another paper. In it, the author suggested striking hard at Pilatism and the icon dauber who plotted to drag it,
into print. Dumbfounded by this term, pilotism, I opened a third paper. Here were two articles, one by Lutunsky and another signed with the letters N.A. Lutunsky's article was entitled A Belligerent Old Believer.
I was so engrossed in reading the article about myself that I did not notice how she appeared before me, a wet umbrella and equally wet newspapers in her hands.
She ran to kiss me, and then, banging her hand on the table, she said in a hoarse voice that she would poison Lutunsky. Utterly joyless days set in. The novel was finished, there was nothing left to do, and our lives were spent sitting on the rug next to the furnace and staring into the fire. We now spent more time apart than before, though. She would go out for walks. As for me, I suddenly acquired a friend. Yes, imagine that. I remember it was a really nice autumn day. She was not home, and a man came through the gate, entered the house on some business with my landlord, and then walked down to the garden and quickly became acquainted with me somehow. He introduced himself as a journalist. Later on, he began to drop by my place. My wife did not like him in the least, but I defended him. What did I find so appealing about him, really? Namely, never before had I met a man with a mind like Aloysius's. If I could not grasp the point of some remark in the paper, Aloysius could explain it to me literally in 1 minute. It was the same with life's various events and questions. But that was not all. Aloysius conquered me with his passion for literature. He would not rest until he coaxed me into reading my entire novel to him from beginning to end. He spoke of the novel very flatteringly, even while guessing all of the editor's remarks about it with remarkable accuracy. What's more, he explained to me with the utmost clarity why my novel could never be published, and I saw that his analysis was flawless. The newspaper articles did not stop. I laughed at the first few, but the more they appeared, the more my attitude towards them changed. The second stage was one of surprise, and then came a third stage. Fear. Not fear of the articles, mind you, but fear of other things. I began to fear the dark. In short, it was the stage of mental illness. No sooner did I extinguish the lamp in my tiny room than I began to imagine some sort of giant squid with very long and cold tentacles crawling in through the small window, even though it was closed, and I had to sleep with the light on. My beloved kept begging my forgiveness for her advice to publish the excerpt. She told me to drop everything and go south to the Black Sea to spend the remainder of my 100 grand on that trip. I promised her to do so in a few days, but she said that she would buy me the ticket herself. Then I took out all of my money, or about 10,000 rubles, and gave it to her. "Why so much?" she asked, surprised. I said something about fearing thieves, and asked her to hold on to my money until my departure. She took it and placed it in her purse. She began to kiss me, and said that she would come tomorrow. This was at dusk in mid-October. She left. I lay down on the couch and fell asleep without lighting the lamp. I awoke from the sensation that the squid was back. Groping about in the dark, I barely managed to turn on the light. My pocket watch showed 2 o'clock in the morning. I went to bed on the verge of illness and woke up ill. I found a bottle of white wine, opened it, and began to drink straight from the bottle. This dulled my fear slightly, enough at least that I did not go running to the landlord, but instead to the furnace. I opened the door, so that the fire scalded my face and hands. I took the heavy manuscripts and draft notebooks of the novel out of my desk drawer and began to burn them. Just then, someone clawed at the window quietly. Placing the final pad into the flames, I rushed to open the door. The moment she stepped inside, she clung to me, all wet, with wet cheeks and tousled hair, shaking. I could only pronounce a single word. "You." She got out of her coat in the hall, and we quickly entered the first room. With a quiet cry, she reached into the furnace with her bare hands and threw out onto the floor the last of what remained there, a sheaf that had caught fire on the bottom. Smoke instantly filled the room. I stamped out the flame with my feet while she sank onto the couch and began to cry wildly and feverishly. When she quieted down, I spoke. "I have come to hate this novel, and I am afraid. I am sick. I am scared." I could feel her cold hands stroking my forehead. "I'll heal you. You'll restore it." "Why? Why didn't I keep a single copy?" She began to gather up and straighten out the burned pages. It was some chapter from the middle of the novel. I don't remember which. She bundled up the burned sheets carefully, wrapped them in paper, and tied them with a ribbon. She demanded wine and, after a drink, spoke more calmly. "This is how one pays for lies, and I don't want to lie anymore. I would stay here with you even now, but I don't want to do it this way. I don't want him to always remember that I ran away from him at night. He never did me any wrong. He was called away suddenly. There was a fire at the factory where he works, but he'll be back soon. I will have a talk with him tomorrow morning, tell him I love another, and return to you forever. But tell me, perhaps you do not want this." "My poor, poor darling," I said to her, "I won't allow you to do this. Bad things will happen to me, and I don't want you to perish with me." "Is that the only reason?" she asked. "The only one." She livened up immensely, clung to me, and said, "In the morning I shall be here." And this is the last I remember of my life. The black silhouette at the outer door and the white package. "Wait a few hours. Tomorrow morning I'll be with you." Those were her last words in my life. A quarter hour after she left me, someone knocked on my window. The sick man was clearly very distressed by whatever he was whispering in Ivan's ear. And so, in the middle of January, at night, I shivered in the cold of my tiny garden. After standing around a while, I went out the gate into the alley. I had nowhere to go, and the simplest solution would have been to throw myself under a tram on the street my alley led to. But, my dear neighbour, the thing was that fear possessed every cell of my body. Yes, you won't find an illness in this building worse than mine, I assure you. "But you could have let her know," Ivan said. "Besides, she had your money, didn't she? Surely she has kept it?" "Of course she has. But evidently, you do not understand me. She would be greeted with a notice from the madhouse. How can one send letters with an address such as this? Mentally ill? No, to make her unhappy. I cannot do that." Ivan had nothing to refute this. So where was I then? The cold, the trams flying by. I knew that this clinic had just opened and crossed the entire city on foot. And so here I am, for the fourth month now. And I don't find it bad here at all, you know. Thank you for the conversation. Goodbye. And before Ivan could gather his wits, the grating closed with a quiet clang, and the guest disappeared.